lesson one in the raising of children was certainly the one that our parents went by. It's epitomized in an old gospel song that we used to sing in family prayers. One of the aspects of our upbringing was singing hymns. Every single morning after breakfast, we went into the living room, and both my parents played the piano, so they would take turns. And we would sing the next hymn in the book. We sang all the stanzas. And these were not praise songs, and they were not choruses. We did have some choruses in those days, but my parents were very strong on teaching us the great hymns of the faith because they are loaded with theology. And they will get you through the night. In the darkest times of my life, it has been hymns that have been such a tremendous bulwark to my faith. And so one of those hymns, probably one of the simplest ones, was an old gospel song called Trust and Obey. And my parents taught us to trust them and to obey immediately. Delayed obedience was treated as disobedience. It was no good for us to say, well, I was just going to. That wasn't good enough. And over the door in every room in the house, my mother had a little 18-inch switch. And we knew that that switch was up there and that it would be used if we did not immediately obey. There was no nonsense like countdowns or timeout. And I would certainly think that's the last thing you people in the military would need to know. I mean, they don't, when the captain says do so and so, you don't get a 10-digit countdown, I wouldn't think. Maybe there is such a thing, but my parents were very clear on the fact that what they said they meant the first time. And so we learned to trust and obey. And of course that's a lesson that goes through life. There's never a time when we're finished with that one. And so as I look back over my very long life, I realize how many times God has had to teach me again in different circumstances that simple maxim, just trust me and do what I say. And that's what my parents did as well. And there are times when we have no idea what to do next, when life seems impossible, hopeless, and perhaps coming to an end. And it is such at such times that God comes near to us and says, will you love me? Will you trust me? Will you praise me? And at that point, my answer has to be yes. And I can very often, in certain situations, do nothing and be nothing, but just bow before the mysterious will of God. Among the many privileges of growing up in our home was the presence of missionaries. My parents entertained missionaries by the dozens. I have my mother's guest book. It has 42 countries represented in it. And we heard missionary stories firsthand at our dinner table through these great saints of God that came through our home. One of my brothers once made the statement when he was just a little boy, we always hear suitcases bumping up and down the stairs in this house. Well, there was a good reason for it, not only for the blessing of the missionaries themselves to have a Christian home to stay in, but the tremendous blessing that it was to all of us children to have those examples, those living, breathing examples at our dinner table. And we heard many horror stories from those missionaries, and we read missionary books, and we knew that missionaries face tremendous danger, and they often get killed, and of course we'd read the Bible stories as well. And we knew about Daniel and his wonderful deliverance from the lions, and we knew about Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who were delivered from the fiery furnace, but we also knew about John the Baptist, who had his head chopped off because he was being obedient to God. And we knew about Stephen, who was stoned to death. And, of course, we knew about Jesus nailed to a cross. I suppose that the deepest impression in my childhood mind was the story of a woman by the name of Betty Scott who came to our home. She sat at our dinner table on her way to China. She was going to marry her fiancé, John Stamm, who was then a missionary in China. I was a very small child when she came through our home, but I was 8 years old when my father came home with a newspaper reporting that John and Betty Stamm had been captured by Chinese communists, stripped half naked, chained together, marched through the streets of the little village, and beheaded. And Betty had had to watch her husband's head chopped off before her own was put on the chopping block. You can imagine that made an indelible impression in my mind and in my heart, because that lady had sat right across the table from me at dinner. So, of course, I knew that to be a missionary is a very dangerous business, and I had hoped, as long as I can remember — I cannot remember a time when I didn't hope — that God would give me the privilege of being a foreign missionary. I couldn't think of anything more wonderful than to have such a privilege, and had always prayed to that end. You might think that that would have dampened my ardor to hear that story, but it did quite the contrary. It drew me powerfully, all the more powerfully, to mission work. And 4 years after that incident, I came across a prayer that Betty Scott Stamm had written in her Bible, I think, when she was about 18 years old. And I made it the prayer of my life and copied it into my Bible. And these are the words: Lord, I give up all my own plans and purposes, all my own desires and hopes, and accept thy will for my life. I give myself, my life, my all, utterly to thee, to be thine forever. Fill me and seal me with thy Holy Spirit. Use me as thou wilt. Send me where thou wilt. And work out thy whole will in my life at any cost, now and forever. And those three words, at any cost, drew me even more ineluctably toward the cross of Jesus Christ and, I still hoped, missionary work. At any cost — could Betty Scott have ever imagined, when she wrote those words, what the cost was going to be? But, of course, I knew what the cost was for her. I didn't have any way of knowing what the cost might be for myself. But a number of tests were administered to me by my loving Heavenly Father by way of preparation for some of the things that were to happen in my life. The most severe test up to that point was when I went away to boarding school in Florida. It was a Christian boarding school, and the headmistress sort of singled me out that first year. I was 14 years old, extremely shy, scared to death, and in utter awe of this redoubtable headmistress. I think back now, and I would describe my relationship with Mrs. DeBose as one of abject terror. She was taller than I am, probably weighed a good 80 pounds more than I do, and then when she came into a room, it was like a galleon in full sail. And we shrank before her. But she was extremely tough with all of us, and I think tougher with me than she was with anybody else in school. I could be wrong about that. But among the things that she taught us daily — and she spoke every evening in what we called Vespers, and every morning her husband spoke in chapel, so we had these two 20-minute sessions each day of spiritual instruction. And in those evening talks, again and again, she would give us a simple maxim: do the next thing. And I don't know any more simplifying principle in my life than doing the next thing. At the worst times of my life, when I just have no idea what to do and I just want to sink into a pile of self-pity, it's a marvelously calming and fortifying thing to simply do the next thing. Another thing she used to say was don't go around with a Bible under your arm if you didn't sweep under the bed. Now, in the military, I'm told that they're pretty picky about the way you keep the barracks and your possessions. And they were very picky in this Bible school, and we had rugs in our bedrooms, not carpets in those days. We had throw rugs and a broom. There were no vacuum cleaners. And every single morning before we went to breakfast, beds had to be made, rooms had to be immaculate, the carpets had to be swept, everything had to be put away where it belonged, and the teachers would go around to the rooms and mark any refraction of the rules. And the names of those who had disobeyed the rules would be read out at lunchtime. Now, what Mrs. DeBose was saying was she didn't want any spiritual talk coming out of a room in which we were being disobedient to the rules. And the rules, of course, in that school were drawn up by the headmaster and the headmistress. They weren't all in the Bible, but the principles were there. And the rules in the military are certainly drawn up by people superior to the privates. And there isn't any argument about them, is there? So that was what she was telling us. It's spiritual work to be obedient to those whom God has put over you. We didn't think of sweeping a room as being very spiritual. Well, it's no good pretending to be spiritual and going around with a Bible under your arm if you're being disobedient to the rules, whatever those rules may be. Well, that was a tough lesson, but it was a lifetime lesson. And, of course, as I grew up, I began to realize that I wasn't learning anything new from Mrs. DeBose that I hadn't heard from my parents over and over again. And so you who have teenage children who are perhaps away at school somewhere, they may come home and think, boy, you've really learned some stuff, you know, not realizing that the things that they have been learning, you have been teaching them long before they went away from home. The second major test of the reality of my commitment to Jesus Christ came at the end of my college years when it suddenly dawned on me that although I was longing to be a foreign missionary, I was not longing to be a single missionary. And I entered into what at Wheaton College in those days we used to call senior panic. If we girls hadn't been able to nail a match on that campus where there were so many unattached and very attractive Christian men, we knew that our chances would be greatly reduced after we graduated. And if we were going to Africa, which is where I thought I was going, my chances would be even further reduced. And so, of course, I began to pray that God would give me a husband. And God didn't seem to be saying anything at all about that prayer. So then I began to sort of scale down what I was asking, and I just said, now, Lord, could you just give me a hint as to whether I'm supposed to be single all my life? And I knew some great single missionaries who had been great blessing in my life, but I didn't want to be one of them. And so I would say, well, Lord, could you just give me a hint? And the Lord gave me the answer that he gives me almost every time, and I want to know something about what is going to happen. He rarely tells us. It's none of our business what is going to happen. It is our business to do what we're supposed to do here and now. So his answer was, will you love me? Will you trust me? Will you praise me? Just trust and obey. Well, I found myself becoming very interested in a certain young man on the campus, and my brother Dave happened to be on the same wrestling team with this man whose name was Jim. And Dave kept saying, you need to get to know this guy Elliot. You'd like him. And I wasn't terribly interested in my younger brother's friends. My brother Dave is all of 13 months younger than I am, but he and Jim were in the same class, and I was in the senior class, and so I wasn't particularly interested. But I took Dave's advice and came to a wrestling match just to see what in the world a wrestling match was, but, of course, mainly to see Jim Elliot. And I was horrified. Not sure that I ever went to another wrestling match. But I had the chance to ask Jim. I said, do you like to wrestle? And he said, well, he said, before the match, I'm scared to death. And in the middle of the match, I'm in agony. And after the match, I'm exhausted. But yes, I like to wrestle. Well, it didn't make any sense at all to me. But then I found out that his primary motive for wrestling was not to become the champion, which he did. He actually became the champion wrestler in his weight class, champion of four states. But Jim had made up his mind back in high school that his body belonged to Jesus Christ. And he took Paul's word, I buffet my body and bring it under subjection, lest having preached to others, I myself should be a castaway. And so this was just one method of keeping his body under subjection. He came from a family where everybody else in the family was overweight. And he had made up his mind that he could not present that kind of a body to the Lord. And so he took up wrestling. Well, just toward the end of that year, when I was very, very interested in him and doing everything I could to prevent his ever getting so much as the slightest clue that I had any interest, because my mother had taught me two things when I was about 13 years old. She said, never chase boys and keep them at arm's length. Now, I have told many young people, young girls, that those two simple rules. And I've told them, if you never chase boys and you always keep them at arm's length, you are never going to find yourself pregnant by mistake. It could never happen. It's a very simple rule. And as far as I could see, it worked for my mother. She had three proposals before my father came along. And, of course, by now it has worked for me because, as you know, I have husband number three with me this evening. The other two are with the Lord. Many of you don't know that I had a second husband for just 4.5 years. He died of cancer. And Lars, I hope, will outlast me. We have three picture frames in our living room with my three husbands in them. Now, I want you to know, get this straight, this was not my idea. This was Lars's idea. And I feel obligated to explain to everybody that comes into the living room that is not my idea. But you know that Lars is a man who is not the least bit threatened by my former husbands. But then, you know, another thought occurred to Lars. He said, we should have gotten four frames, and then you could have put a question mark in the fourth frame. The story of Jim Elliot and me is all told in intimate detail in the book called Passion and Purity. So I'm not going to tell you much more of that story, except that one evening after Jim had confessed his love for me, which was just a few weeks before I graduated, we had had long conversations, and it was very clear to both of us that God was calling us to the mission field, perhaps in different directions. I was pretty sure I was going to Africa. Jim was very sure he was going to South America. I was graduating. Jim was not graduating. He lived in Oregon. I lived in New Jersey. And the chances of our ever seeing each other again seemed to be zero. But Jim simply said, I'm not asking you to marry me. He said, I'm not going to lay a finger on you. I have no claims on you whatsoever. I'm not going to ask you to wait for me. He said, you go ahead and go to Africa. He said, if God wants to bring us together, God knows how to do that. But for now, God has not given me any green light whatsoever. Maybe he wants me to remain single, perhaps for the rest of my life. And one evening, just shortly before I graduated, we went for a walk, and we just stumbled into a cemetery without really thinking and sat down on a marble slab that was convenient, arms length apart. Believe me. And I said to Jim, I don't think it makes sense for us to carry on a correspondence after I graduated, because that would be sort of like trying to hold on to some strings wouldn't it be best if we just leave that with God? And there was this long silence, and then Jim said, well, he said, you know, I don't like the idea, but he said, I think you're right, because this morning in my Bible reading, the story was that of Abraham offering his son Isaac on the altar to God. And he said, Abraham offered the most precious thing in his life. He said, you're the most precious thing in my life, so I have put you on the altar, and that's where you're going to stay, unless God provides a ram or some other method, as he did in Abraham's case. And we sat in some long silence after that. And suddenly I realized that the moon had risen behind us and was casting the shadow of a stone cross on that slab between us. Amy Carmichael wrote, Lord crucified, O mark thy holy cross on motive, preference, all fond desires, on that which self in any form inspires, set thou that sign of loss. And when the touch of death is here and there laid on a thing most precious in our eyes, let us not wonder. Let us recognize the answer to this prayer. And so that was the deepest lesson up to that point. I was 21, Jim was 20. The deepest lesson in what the cross means. And of course, Betty Scott Stamm had set the tone in my life. Work out thy whole will in my life at any cost. At any cost. Now and forever. I went to Ecuador in 1952, single. I went to the western jungle to work with two British missionaries who had been struggling with an unwritten Indian tribal language. They had no linguistic training. I had that kind of training, and so the Lord gave me the privilege of working with these two women to reduce what was called the Colorado language. Those of you that speak Spanish know that Colorado simply means red. These people painted themselves literally bright red from head to toe, so they were a very colorful tribe. But no one had ever learned their language except one white man who spoke both Spanish and Colorado, which was a wonderful blessing. I had prayed that God would enable me to find someone who could help me with this translation work. And I was told there was no one who spoke both languages, but here was a man who spoke those languages and was also out of a job, prepared to work for me at my price, and on top of all of it, he turned out to be a Christian. He was absolutely thrilled to participate in the work of, ultimately, we hoped, Bible translation. But of course, the first job is just slogging through, trying to create an alphabet and all of that sort of thing. During that year, there were four major blows to my faith. I had not yet been a missionary one whole year in the jungle. Four things happened. My informant, this man named Macario, after just about 6 or 8 weeks of working very happily and effectively together, he was murdered at point-blank range in broad daylight, with about 6 witnesses. Now, what would you have said to God? 3-letter word, right? Why? God had given me a gift in linguistics. God had called me to Ecuador instead of to Africa. God had sent me to exactly the right man. We had worked together very happily and effectively. And God allowed him to be murdered. Before that year was up, I had to watch a woman die in childbirth. It was a horrible, horrible scene. And then when I moved to the eastern jungle, because Jim Elliott by that time had asked me finally to marry him, we had waited 5 years from that scene in the cemetery till the proposal in Quito, Ecuador. And in order to say yes, I had to fulfill one condition. Jim said, I will not marry you until you learn Quechua. So I'd had to study Spanish first, and then I had to study Colorado. Now I was going to have to study Quechua. But I didn't think it was too high a price to pay to get a man like Jim Elliott, and so I said yes. And I had to move to the eastern jungle where I could begin the study of Quechua. And I had not been there very long when I got a radio message from my fiancé, Jim, that the entire station on which he had been working that whole year had just gone down the river in a flood. All the buildings, three of them he had built with his own hands, two of them he had repaired, they all went. And a few weeks after that, I received a letter from my two British colleagues with whom I had left all of my Colorado language material, telling me that all of that stuff had been stolen. A murder, a death, a flood, and a robbery. In every case, it just seemed as though God wasn't there. And there are many times in our adult Christian life when there's nothing to do but bow before the unexplained. William Cooper wrote that magnificent hymn, God moves in a mysterious way his wonders to perform. He plants his footsteps in the sea. Invisible footsteps, aren't they? And rides upon the storm. Do you evade the hard questions? Just ignore them? Bury them? What do you do? I believe that faith's most severe tests come not when it seems to me that there is nothing, that God is doing nothing, but the most severe tests are in those occasions when God seems to present a stunning array of evidence which prove that my faith is in vain. And at such a time, you stand, as it were, on the edge of an abyss, and you look down into that abyss, and there's no light, and there's no answer to your why. And of course, you ask all those terrible questions, Lord, did you call me to the mission field? Did I come to the wrong field? Did I make a mistake and go to the wrong tribe? Why did you allow all these things to happen in our very first year? And then, of course, the terrible question, Lord, are you up there? Is my faith vain? Is your word empty? Untrue? Do you love me? And I went back to Betty Scott Stamm's prayer. I give up all my own plans and purposes, all my own desires and hopes. And of course, I had, I confess, a great hope that I might be someday known as the apostle to the Colorado Indians, for example. I could see that as a very nice title to a book, you know. I would reduce this language to writing and be known because of it. And so the Lord just took his arm and swept everything I had done right off the board. And Jim had toiled away in the heat of the jungle in the eastern Amazon rainforest. And the Lord took his other arm, it seemed, and just swept everything he had done down the Amazon River. And I just remember those years, those months when I was living with the Colorado Indians, when my informant was killed, his body was brought out into the clearing so that everybody could look, and there was a big hole in his head, and he was laid out on a poncho, which of course was bloody, and that poncho was hanging over a fence for about 3 weeks after the man was buried, and every time I would look at that poncho just covered with blood, I would want to say, Lord, why? Why? But you know, it's in acceptance that peace lies. And it is to Amy Carmichael, that amazing Irish missionary to India, that I owe my understanding of that. what the cross means. And she said, in acceptance lieth peace. And we can rave and scream and cry and thrust our fist at the sky and declare that God isn't there or that God doesn't love me. But that's not going to bring us any kind of peace at all. In acceptance lieth peace, which is an honest, earnest, and unequivocal yes, Lord. I give up all my own plans and purposes, all my own desires and hopes, and accept thy will for my life. Now, I don't know what you may be struggling with tonight. Struggling with God. Wrestling, perhaps. The Bible says Jesus Christ learned obedience by the things which he suffered. Learned obedience. Imagine the Lord of the universe, the infinite majesty, being reduced to having to learn obedience like a little child. That he learned it through the things that he suffered. And if God is going to make us servants, the very first thing we have to understand is that a servant has no agenda of his own. A servant is at the orders of other people. The private has no agenda of his own in the army, I suppose. But he has to learn obedience. And it is as we learn that great lesson of acceptance, accepting what seems to us the unacceptable will of God, that God gives himself to us. That's the wonderful side of it. In those darkest times, those most inexplicable times, that God comes to us and says, I'm here. I love you. I've got the whole world where? In my hands. He's got you and me, brother and sister, in his hands. And he's not going to let us go. When my dear friend, whom I call Van, she was one of my schoolmates at Wheaton, she went to Africa as a missionary. I went to South America, and it wasn't until 13 years later, when she got kicked out by the Sudanese government, that she and I got together. And we talked for days about God's dealings with us. She'd been there for 13 years. I had been there about 11 at that time. And I'll never forget Van saying to me, Bet, she said, my feet were on the rock, and the rock never moved. But everything else in us is shaken, isn't it? We've all had experiences where everything that's shakable gets shaken, doesn't it? Are your feet on the rock? Is the rock ever going to move? No. And if Jesus Christ had to learn obedience by the things which he suffered, let's remember that in that learning process, what was he being prepared for? He suffered many things that you and I will certainly don't know anything about from the scriptures, because we know of nothing until he was 30 years old, and only those 3 years are very sketchy. But what was his reward here on earth? As he learned obedience by the things which he suffered, the reward was desolation and crucifixion. Horrible, hideous, ignominious death. And he says to us, do you want to be my disciple? If you want to be my disciple, and these are the first conditions of discipleship, give up your right to yourself. That's the first condition of discipleship. Fits in so perfectly, doesn't it, with our motto. Make me a servant. Okay? First thing we have to do, relinquish our plans and purposes, our desires and hopes, and put ourselves at the disposal of somebody else. And Jim Elliot had written in my yearbook, You know, we used to get as many kids on the campus sign their names on our year, on our yearbooks. And my senior year, of course, Jim was a junior. And I asked him for his autograph. I along with another 100 girls or so, dying to get Jim Elliott's autograph. And he wrote under it, 2 Timothy 2:4. Well, I had no idea what that was, but of course you can imagine it didn't take me very long to get my Bible and find out what this cryptic message was that Jim had for me. And this is what it said. A soldier on active service will not become entangled in civilian affairs. He must be wholly at his commanding officer's disposal. 2 Timothy 2:4. Jim Elliott knew that he was disposable. And so the Lord gradually worked up to letting him die by disposing of all kinds of things. He had to dispose of his girlfriend when I left Wheaton. He had to dispose of the entire station on which he'd worked so hard. He had to dispose of a good many ambitions that he had as a missionary. And then he got disposed of by means of wooden spears thrown by some Indians whom I later got to know very well. But I say to you tonight that each separate occasion of individual stripping, each experience, is a fragment of Christ's sufferings. Now that may sound like a preposterous statement, but you know, the Bible makes it very clear that we are given the privilege of helping to fill up the quota of the sufferings of Christ. Did you ever stop to think about that? Well, it's in Colossians 1:24, I think it is. Colossians, Ephesians, Philippians, Colossians. Colossians 1:24 and Philippians 1:29, where Paul says, unto you it is given not only to believe, but also to suffer. Not only to believe, but also to suffer. That is a gift. Have you ever stopped to think of suffering as a gift? It is in the gift of suffering that Christ gives himself to you and me. I had no idea about that until God took me through many deep waters and hot fires. And it has taken me far too long. I'm ashamed to think how long it has taken me to realize the magnificence of that gift of suffering. I have been asked a good many times, why do you talk so much about suffering? I write about it, I talk about it, and I talk about it on my radio program. My answer is very simple. Did you know that the New Testament speaks more than 100 times about suffering? I don't know if there's any other topic in the New Testament that tops that one. We must suffer. Period. Case closed. That's the long and the short of it. But in every separate experience of individual stripping, and I don't know what your experience of individual stripping has been, but think of it as helping to fill up that quota, that mysterious quota that Paul talks about in Colossians 1. It's as though there's a quota of suffering that must be completed in God's people. And until that is completed, he's not coming back. It says in Isaiah 53, he hath borne our griefs and carried our sorrows. He has dealt with it all. He himself was stricken and smitten. And it says, it pleased the Lord to bruise him. Isn't that mysterious? What do we do with this sorrow? There is something that we can do besides sinking into a swamp of self-pity, which is the great temptation, particularly of us women, I guess. We feel very sorry for ourselves. Why did the Lord do this? I don't understand why the Lord did that. Well, there is something that we can do with it. This total loss, which empties my hands and breaks my heart, is something which, if I will, like an offer to Jesus Christ. I had no idea about that until my second husband was dying of cancer. And I had never been through anything like that situation. My first husband's death was very quick, and I wasn't there at the time. Quick by comparison with cancer. And I had to watch my husband die. And it was in those dark, terrible hours between 2 and 4 in the morning, which someone has said it's like all life's molehills become mountains. And it was in those times that I began to realize that I could not offer anything to Jesus Christ until I was willing to receive what God had given to me. God is standing there offering to you and me himself. And when he offers himself, he is offering his own suffering. And he is offering your suffering. Asking, will you give this back to me? And as I lay in bed one night, I suddenly thought about the feeding of the 5,000. When the disciples brought that ridiculous little pitiful lunch to Jesus, 5 loaves and 2 fishes, and I often wonder if the poor boy was, if it was extorted out of his hands or if he gave it up willingly. But you remember that Andrew said to Jesus as they presented this feeble offering, what is the good of that for such a crowd? Well, that's exactly what I was thinking. God wants me to give him my suffering? What is the good of that? And then I remembered one thing that a missionary had said when I was a student at Wheaton College. I remember practically nothing else of anything that anybody said in chapel in those days. We had compulsory chapel 5 days a week. But this missionary said, if your life is broken when given to Jesus, it may be because pieces will feed a multitude when a loaf would satisfy only a little boy. If your life is broken when given to Jesus, it may be because pieces will feed a multitude when a loaf would satisfy only a little boy. And so I said, well, Lord, I don't know what you can do with this, but I give you my pain. You know, it has changed my life. There have been a lot of sufferings and pains since then. That husband died back in 1973. But the Lord again and again has to review the lessons, doesn't he? Every lesson that we ever learn, we think, okay, we can just forget about that one now. Well, never. I find as I give myself back to Jesus Christ that I then have something to offer. I can receive from him his joy, his understanding, his perfection. And as I give it back to him in mysterious exchange, he gives it to me. Gives himself to me. And I want to read a poem by Amy Carmichael, which epitomizes everything here. But these strange ashes, Lord, this nothingness, this baffling sense of loss. Sun was the anguish of my stripping less upon the torturing cross. Was I not brought into the dust of death, a worm and no man I? Yea, turned to ashes by the vehement breath of fire on Calvary. And this is Jesus talking to this person who writes, O Son beloved, this is thy heart's desire. This and no other thing follows the fall of the consuming fire on the burnt offering. Go on and taste the joy set high afar. No joy like that to thee. See how it lights the way like some great star. Come now and follow me. God bless you.